So am I still waiting? Waiting a long time.
Waiting for tonight.
Listen to review,
right now, right? That's what you say. We get it by now.
What is this? What is he doing here? This Wolfpack wannabe.
Guess he's trying to prove that he deserves a right to wear those colors. The all he deserves is a spear from Goldberg.
Bam Bam's in.
Bam Bam Bigelow.
Remember, this is no disqualification.
Absolutely it is. And Bigelow, once again, uninvited.
Whoa!
Not supposed to be here. Send him to jail.
Meanwhile, Nash gets a break.
What was that?
That's one of those tasers, a police use.
It's like a stun gun. That was Scott Hall.
That was Scott Hall, and you could hear it clicking. It was like a cattle prodder, a stun gun.
Kevin Nash never saw that.
And he jabbed it in the midsection of Goldberg.
Oh, no.
Wait a minute.
He...
Jackknife powerbomb!
Could this be it? 1, 2, 3!
The streak is over!
And we have a new world champion!
The streak is over! 173-1, and a new world champion, Kevin Nash, is crowned world heavyweight champion!
All along the western front, well, I'm out to receive.
It is Review Away. John Pollock here, along with Wei Ting. And Wei, we are in the midst. Oh, you're.
I didn't even hear you.
What did you just do?
I thought I had a burp. I thought I had more in me.
Oh,
didn't.
But still conscientious enough to say excuse me.
Yeah, to force a habit.
Are you at following Monday, and what I brought to Review a Raw? Are you fully in the Christmas spirit now?
Oh man, it's been such a long time. I almost forget
the official Review a Raw Christmas decoration.
Oh,
I mean, you were in awe of it when I showed it to you. You were speechless.
I'm speechless right now just even thinking about it.
No, not enough time to react.
Nope.
I'm gonna have to wait till next week,
though. Yeah, I mean, I'll probably have the same reaction.
Actually, I'm thinking now I'm not even going to get to talk to you next week.
Yes. Wow. Yes. No, I will be in Vegas. Yes. So I won't get to talk to you.
Yep.
So
you are going to cover the biggest week of the year for the UFC.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get to see some of the best fights of the entire year.
Yes, I will.
And you're leaving me here?
I mean, I'll be in the back, so I won't necessarily be
I'm living
watching.
Vicariously through you, Wei.
Yeah. Okay.
What are you looking forward to next week?
That whole week? Of 3 nights of straight fights?
Yes. Like, what are the fights that... I mean, you are probably not dissecting each and every fight, but there are some big fights happening.
I'm looking forward to all the headlining bouts on all three shows, I think.
What's number one for you?
Oh, well, Conor and Aldo.
It is.
Of course.
For me, it's Weidman-Rockhold.
Okay, cool.
I just love that fight.
Yeah, that'll be great.
But, I mean... Man, you're going to get Frankie Edgar and Chad Mendes
mm-hmm.
the night before 194, which is ridiculous.
Yep.
Jacare Souza and Yoel Romero on 194. I mean, even my new favorite fighter, Sage Northcutt, on Thursday night.
Mm-hmm.
This guy has the best social media game going.
He's got a really weird, but yeah, that's what makes
it. It was so much way that I felt, am I the only one that's getting this? So I had to start sending you the photos so that you can get it too. I mean, this guy is just...
He's blown up. Even on... it's not just us. Like, on Reddit, people will, like, remark about weird things that he's been doing. And he... Like, everything he's doing is like a meme. You know what I mean? It's perfect for memeing.
Like, look at this. Nighttime brain chains. The best one.
What are we looking at? This is radio, man.
You're right. Here, on Sage Northcutt's Facebook profile, here he is. Protecting myself from this hot, I Burn Calm hot sauce before I head over to their store to hang out and eat more. And he's in front of a fireplace with no shirt on, putting the hot sauce in a bowl with a motorcycle helmet on. I mean, this dude is like... And I feel he knows, like, he's totally in on it, which is so funny.
Yeah, of course.
I think he's just...
You should start doing that. You got to step up your social media game.
Well,
why aren't you on Instagram yet?
Because you are. Braden was in charge of that. I don't know.
Why don't you have your own personal Instagram?
I don't post photos, though. I don't take photos.
Why not?
Because I don't... You know what the last photo I posted? You know how withy it was? I was walking on Queen Street last week, on the Tuesday, actually, after Raw.
Yeah.
And I passed by the Carl's Juniors, and there was a ad for the Tex-Mex.
Yeah, I saw that. That was funny.
No, it wasn't.
Yeah, it was.
It's just a stupid Euro.
That was funny.
Loser post.
No, you could have put that up on Instagram. I'm sure it would have gotten plenty of likes.
Yeah, I guess.
And it would have felt good.
I'm sure it would have. By the way, do you realize that Thursday night card, it's got Paige VanZant, Sage Northcutt.
Yes.
And Elias Theodoro.
It's like all the pretty people
on one card.
Yeah, I'll say, yeah, in terms of a pound-for-pound best-looking UFC.
Like if Sam Stout didn't retire, he'd be on that card,
yeah.
I feel.
Yeah, definitely.
And you're going to be there.
No, yeah, of course. So that's it.
Are you
going to be dissecting this on the MMA report?
Sage Northcutt's Facebook profile?
The best looking people.
See, I was offered an interview with Sage Northcutt the day before his fight, which is unfortunate because the MMA report comes out on Thursday night / Friday morning, and it airs late Friday night. So his fight will be over by the time the show airs.
It's sort of an unfortunate time. I mean, most days it works out because it's, you know, fights are Saturday.
Exactly. Most times it works. Unfortunately, this one, part of me thinks I should still just go ahead. I just want to interview this guy.
Yeah, you should.
He to me, is the fighter I am most intrigued by.
You should do two interviews. One if he wins and one if he loses.
I should preface it by saying, Sage, this will air after your fight. This means nothing in terms of promotion. This is technically a waste of your time and a complete benefit of mine.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should go with that angle. He'd probably... Cool.
Yeah.
Super.
Mm-hmm.
Duper.
And he'll probably post a photo of him doing the interview.
Waste of my time with his watch.
Yeah.
Which was another great one in his car.
Oh, I didn't see that.
With the jacked up arm. I sent this one to you.
Oh.
And he's got his watch and his arm that just looks ridiculous. And the caption is, anybody know what time it is? All right, you're done with Sage Northcutt.
No,
I understand. We can move on.
Yeah, I kind of am. Kind of bored with this conversation.
Can you share with us the big alteration you made to your home over the weekend? You added some art.
Yeah, sure.
You've become an obsessive masturbator.
Yes, I have. Yeah, there's this great website called masturbator.net, I think. And it's not what it's totally safe for work. It's what it is it takes a
Rasturbator.com.
Yeah, Rasturbator, R-A-S-T. And it takes photos, whatever JPEGs you want, and it basically it blows it up so that you can make like a wall size poster of any image that you want by separating, you know, the image into however many pages that you can print out of your own home printer. And this past week, I put up this big thing on my glass door of Joe Carter's home run from the 93 World Series.
Which you told me, you said ahead of time, I decided to get a photo of the greatest moment of my life.
Yeah, it was.
And I didn't know what you were going to be showing me.
I feel like I...
maybe like your baptism.
No.
Maybe your first steps. Maybe
I remember
a jiu-jitsu tournament.
No, I remember specifically in like grade 8, I was asked to like rank the best moments of your life, and I put that as my number one.
Oh, do you remember any others?
It was my number two moment. Number one was being born.
So. I don't have any recollection of my birth. Technically.
I feel like we've had this exact conversation in this spot on this podcast. Like,
it's going to happen.
Deja vu.
It's going to happen. Do you remember any other moments from your top 10 at 8?
I feel like
grade 8.
I mean, it was more like monumental moments slash best moments. You know, I guess immigrating to this country was a big moment for me.
Do you remember that?
Yeah.
You were old enough to remember?
Yeah, vaguely. I mean, I was 5 at the time, so I remember like kind of being on the plane, not exactly sure like where I was going. I'll tell you, the one thing that really stood out, though, was like when I came to my house, which ended up, you know, being like, which my parents, it was my home, my actual house. Like, the thing that really stood out to me was the pull tabs on the pop cans.
Yes.
Like in Hong Kong, we had the old pull tabs that you actually pulled off.
Oh, really?
That you can, I don't know if you ever experienced that.
Not on pop cans.
Okay. But like, you know what I'm talking
yes,
about, right?
Yes, yes, yes.
You pull, like on Red Bull, don't they have, oh no, they don't, never mind. Some drinks, they have to actually have the pull tab that you pull off, and it becomes like this, basically like a razor blade that you, you know, it's just very sharp.
So it's got a dual purpose.
Well, it's an antiquated form of pop can technology, which I think in Hong Kong they have changed to the. This is a thrilling podcast.
No, I'm curious by this.
But like this, that stood out to me because like something like a can of Coke is just. You know, a very.
Are you talking about like the like when you have a can of like
soda,
pineapples, for instance, and there's the it's like a pop can thing, but then you tear off the top metal part.
Yeah, not the whole thing, not the whole circle. It's not like a can of tuna.
But it takes off just the portion,
the mouth.
Yes.
Yeah. This show sucks.
No, this is awesome.
Anyway,
I don't think we'll even get the Starcade this week.
Something like a can of soda. I think as a kid, you know, for me, it was just a very familiar, I guess, image. And why are you laughing?
I'm not.
You're laughing at my life.
No, I'm not.
You're laughing at my childhood.
No.
So then I come to Canada, and like all of a sudden, like a can of Coke is completely different. There's no Chinese on this Coke. The fucking thing, the mouth it opens differently. How do I open this? I didn't even know how to open it.
And you're how old?
I was 5.
Wow. This is a lot to process for a 5-year-old.
So, like, you know, I think that was, like, the first bit of culture shock I experienced was that distinct image I remember very well.
Wow.
I also remember a box of Count Chocula cereal in my home. With like an Indiana Jones advertisement on the back, and I never ate that stuff in Hong Kong. So that's
did that you just have standard cereal over there? You didn't have all this gimmicky shit.
I mean, there's cereal, but cereal I don't think it's that popular in Hong Kong.
I don't know how popular it is here. To be quite honest,
popular. Milk is not really like. I mean, it actually is, but like I don't know. I don't think cereal. I could be wrong. It could be very popular by now. Cereal in Hong Kong.
Maybe it has taken off.
Yeah.
Question for our international listeners. See, I hate cereal, God. So I can't really speak to its level of
you
popularity
love milk,
anywhere.
Though.
Yeah, but cereal is not milk. It's
like it's one of those.
It's crap that's all soggy.
No, it's
with
a
milk.
It's a best friend of milk. You can't have.
It seems like a terrible. Like, if someone came up with that and told you of this breakfast idea they came up with, cold milk with stale wheat inside of it. It's like, that sounds gross. Well, it is gross.
No, it's not. It's delicious.
When was the last time you had cereal?
Nice and sugary.
When was the last time you had. Exactly. It's not good for you either.
It's not good.
It's probably
for
the
you.
Worst thing yeah. to start a child off with in the morning. They yeah. hit a wall by noon.
I don't necessarily doubt that. It depends on the type of cereal, though. You can get like a nice multi-grain, like oatmeal type of thing. The last time I had cereal,
I'm more of a smoothie person. A smoothie or
you become
a bagel.
You become a smoothie person.
I do typically have a smoothie
nice.
In the
what
morning.
What do you use? Like a Nutribullet?
Yes.
Cool.
It's great. I need quick.
Give me a smoothie recipe. Your favorite.
Blueberries with banana, protein powder, and sometimes you can add like some raspberries, but I find they take over the flavor and it's kind of a sourness to them. I love blueberry and banana. I think is a tremendous underrated blending.
What's your base?
Fruit.
What's your base?
Milk. Like, I do use milk.
Milk.
I think water. It's just like, come on.
No, I usually go juice.
Skim milk.
Yeah.
Skim milk is fine.
I usually go juice or almond milk.
I had a hot chocolate over the weekend. I was out at this the Christmas market in downtown Toronto.
Yeah.
And I got a hot chocolate. This thing tasted so thick and sweet. I couldn't even drink a third of it. I had to throw it out. It was just so...
Yeah, not that bad.
It was too sweet.
I definitely... That was like something else you'll notice if, you know, just throwing it back to that, to moving here from Hong Kong, is just that the palate for sweetness in North America is far higher than it is in Asia. Like you buy like a cake. Like whenever like my parents and I, we buy like birthday cakes, we always go to the Asian bakeries. Because the North American cakes are just, like, so sweet. They're just loaded with a lot of sugars to the point where it makes the stuff not taste as good. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you feel gross afterwards.
Kind of, yeah.
Kind of how I felt after this hot chocolate.
Mm.
Just had to dump it.
Okay. Wow.
So much like North American cake,
oh my God.
Today's review is going to focus on Kevin Nash, whose booking he thought was just too sweet.
All right, I was waiting to see how that would turn out. That was pretty good.
And we're gonna have some guests on the show today, Mr. Ting. I did some digging over the weekend. I got out my shovel and I went into the archives, not just the law archives, but also the Fight Network Radio archives, where we are gonna hear from Bill Goldberg, discussing this period of time in WCW and working with the likes of Hulk Hogan, Kevin Nash, and some choice words for Scott Hall, which he shared in 2007. And then we're also going to hear from Kevin Nash. I'm debating which one I'm going to run. There is the interview that Mauro Ranallo did, a sit down with Kevin Nash for the Fight Network back in 2008. And then there's a horrible one conducted by myself where I can't stand. I was horrendous.
Okay, I want to hear that
one. In 2005, for the enjoyment of all of you, I will probably play that one.
Yeah, of course. Morals.
It's
not
terrible.
This is not
like, if I was listening to this, I would hate me.
Okay,
I hated my voice.
Well, let us be the judge of that. You're lowering my expectations, or you're actually increasing my expectations. So
it kind of helped me because I feel there's no way I'm this bad any longer. I have to be better than this.
Okay.
I sound better than this.
Well,
10 years later,
we'll be the judge of that.
I wish we had interviews from you from 10 years ago.
I didn't do many interviews. The only interviews I did were like...
The weigh-ins?
Yeah.
I think those age very well.
No, I don't.
My Kevin Nash interview from May of 2005 as he was promoting The Longest Yard? Not quite.
Oh, vaguely remember that.
It was the first time...
Is that what we're going to hear? The one you're gonna play?
Yes.
Okay.
It's
cool.
From 2005. It was the first time I had ever interviewed Kevin Nash, and Kevin Nash is a very pleasant guy to interview. I think he's Kevin Nash, honest.
I don't know if that's true, because we spoke to him at like a some type of convention, some type of a sports card convention.
You're right. We did interview him there.
Yeah.
I don't recall him being bad.
He was fine.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah, I'm saying Kevin Nash had a good interview.
Okay.
You thought I said bad.
Yeah.
No. No, Kevin Nash, you can question his thinking or his recollections of certain things, but he's a very engaging individual to speak with.
Mm-hmm.
And this first time I talked to him, I went into all these interviews in 2005 thinking, I'll never speak to these people again. So I know we're promoting a movie, but I'm going to ask him every question I've possibly had. And that included his booking, the finger poke of doom,
mm-hmm.
Stupid. Some questions are just, ugh.
Okay, ugh. We'll get to hear them.
Well, we're not going to play the whole interview. We're going to play the relevant parts to this.
You're only going to play the good parts? All right.
The parts that are meaningful. I mean, this isn't a Kevin Nash retrospective. It is a look at December of 1998. As I said last week, the first pay-per-view that yours truly ever bought. We had just gotten a pay-per-view cable box. And I tested it out a week earlier by ordering the movie Godzilla,
mm-hmm.
featuring Puff Daddy providing the title song for.
Yeah.
Come
great.
With Me.
Yeah, great song.
And then
classic.
And then on Sunday, December 27th, I was so excited for this. It was the first time I could watch a pay-per-view and see what was happening on the screen. And that day, my good pal invited me to go skiing with him. So we went skiing, and then at the end of it, it's like 5 o'clock or so, and him and his mom, I think one of their friends, they were like, do you guys want to go out for dinner? And I'm saying, no, I want to go home. I want to go watch Starcade. I don't want to go out for dinner. And we ended up going out for dinner, and I got home at like 10 after 8 whenever the pay-per-view started. And I'm calling my brother ahead of time. Couldn't even text in 1998. I'm just like, make sure you tape this. I don't want to miss any of this event. And I was just furious. I'm like, I just want to get home and watch this pay-per-view event. So this tells you how excited I was for a WCW pay-per-view, no less, at the end of 1998, featuring a very famous match, I guess, in pro wrestling history, Bill Goldberg and Kevin Nash, their version of The Undertaker and Brock Lesnar.
Or Ronda Rousey versus Holly Holm.
Or Vladimir Klitschko and Tyson Fury.
Oh, wow.
A lot of upsets of late. It took place Sunday, December the 27th, from Washington, D.C. Have you ever seen this show before?
I've seen the main event. I hadn't seen the rest of the show. No.
This was a very, very interesting show that I have many thoughts on. This was, up until this point in time, WCW set their pay-per-view gate record for this particular show. Not their overall gate record, but looking at how big WCW was at this time. This is the end of 1998. Everyone has seen the cracks forming, and 1998 was not going to be a pretty year for them, but 98 was their most profitable year. And just think about this way. They were doing three-hour Nitros, okay? On December 7th, they ran Nitro at the Astrodome in Houston with 32,000 people.
Wow.
2 weeks later, they ran Nitro in St. Louis at the TWA Dome, 29,000 people and a new company gate record. Then they have Starcade, which would be, 460,000 buys. And then the following week was the Georgia Dome show featuring the Finger Poke of Doom, setting a new company gate record with 34,788 people. In the course of a month, they did 90,000 people paid.
That's incredible.
And this is looked upon as the time when WCW was off the rails. To me, I look at this company, they were so fixated on ratings at the time, which Raw was beating them. They were still doing unbelievable business at this time. And Raw was not running stadium events. I mean, the Astrodome, the WWE has run WrestleManias there. Outside of that Skydome Raw, the WWF was not running stadium events and putting 32, 34,000 people in there for their television show. It was incredible, the business they were doing, and how salvageable this thing was at the end of 1998. It was not salvageable, apparently. But at this point in time, my God, this company was still on fire. They opened up with a video of Goldberg with this weird countdown timer in the bottom right-hand corner and various shots of different parts of his body.
Muscles.
Different muscles.
Close-ups of muscles.
The many muscles of Bill Goldberg. And then Tony Schiavone welcomes us by stating, "In a city where the fate of the free world is decided on a daily basis, the fate of WCW will be decided tonight." And then welcomes us and links the WCW title going back to 1905, which would not be accurate lineage. But nonetheless, the state of the free world taking place in Washington, what a perfect place for WCW's year-end pay-per-view, Starcade. Did you enjoy Tony Schiavone on this show? We had Tony Schiavone, Bobby Heenan, and Mike Tenay as our announce team.
I think Schiavone gets a lot of, he gets a bad rep in pro wrestling's history. There are certain parts where I thought he was fine, but sometimes I thought it was a little warranted here. I thought it was just hard to, I didn't think he provided a really credible voice. There were many times where I just felt like he kind of sounded almost sarcastic in his commentary. Like he couldn't take this stuff seriously.
Yes, I think there was a lot of that. I'll say the WWE Network recently put up like 40 episodes of Jim Crockett Promotions and their Saturday night 6:05 show. And I've been going back and watching a few of these. Tony Schiavone was excellent as the host or co-host of these shows. These are such fun shows to go back and watch. And how fast-paced this two-hour wrestling show was. And Tony Schiavone with his mustache in 1985. Tremendous stuff. Bischoff has announced that the Horsemen are banned from the building tonight, right as there was a laser pen on Tony Schiavone's face to really emphasize 1998. Do you want to share for our younger listeners the phenomenon that was laser pens, laser pointers in 1998? These were a big thing, and they were so stupid.
Yes, they were. Did you have one?
No, I didn't have one because someone had once told me, and I was a very gullible 14-year-old, that if you used a laser pen and you hit someone right in the pupil, they'd go blind.
That was the rumor.
You had heard it too?
Yeah.
Oh, so it wasn't just me.
Well, I actually did it to my brother. I pointed it in my brother's eye by accident.
You're nuts.
It hurt him.
It hurt him?
I mean, it probably...
But did he mess with you?
No, it blinded him for a second.
Holy crap, really?
Yeah, it's not good for your eyes at all.
Wow.
It didn't blind him, though.
These were largely reserved for people fucking around during movies.
Yeah.
Where they would just...
Well, what they're actually meant for, I think they are for, like, presentations, you know, when you give a presentation.
Not for people under the age of 18 who... My recollection of it being used was being in a theater for I Know What You Did Last Summer, and a guy constantly holding his light up on Jennifer Love Hewitt's nipples. And the whole theater laughing.
That's very funny.
That's what laser pens were used for in 1998.
I kind of wish they would make a comeback. It just died off.
Yeah. Remember that string of those movies? There was, I think, I Still Know What You Did Last Summer. It came out in 1998.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The first one was very good, by the way.
I didn't see it.
Way has no time for chit-chat. This is a lengthy event.
Oh, sorry.
Bobby Heenan. Poor Bobby Heenan. If you want to get a state of his post-financial state of mind after Starrcade, said that he's putting the mortgage on the house on Goldberg tonight. Bobby, you know, he should know better. Wrestling business. You can never bet the mortgage on anybody. So the Horsemen are banned for tonight's match involving Eric Bischoff and Ric Flair. Then we got a plug for a QVC event happening in Philadelphia later that week, where we got these random comments from the likes of Bret Hart and Scott Steiner and Chris Jericho. It was going to be a live event in Philadelphia, and it was going to be a tie-in with QVC, which was like the home shopping network.
Mm-hmm.
And it ended with the line of Chris Jericho saying, "I guarantee this ain't going to be no jewelry show." I didn't know what this was going to be, nor was I intrigued to find out.
It featured basically Jericho, Steiner, and Bret reading this very...
Your perfect pitch, man.
Very dry script.
Yeah, and I mean, like, leading off the show with this big plug.
It was an odd placement for this, definitely, at the top of the show. I mean, this plus the Okerlund hotline after this. We aren't even at the first match, and you're already trying to sell me a bunch of stuff on this pay-per-view that I paid $40 for.
These were some moneymakers. The 1-900 hotline, which Gene Okerlund got a cut of to put his breaking news on, and he said how Steve McMichael's been escorted out of the building, plugs the hotline, and then notes that there is some backstage happenstance.
If you're doing a hotline and you're charging by the minute, do you think there's more incentive for somebody like Okerlund to speak slower?
Can you imagine us? All of our detours?
Oh, yes. Imagine you have to pay. Like,
just get to the results! I just want to know if Goldberg won! And is my house in danger?
$1.99 a minute for this podcast?
Oh, did you ever call into a wrestling hotline?
No. Not the ones you have to pay for.
I called in and I hung up before the minute, so I never got charged.
Oh, lucky you. How much news did you get?
Nothing. I only got to the menu, and then they just take forever to read the menu. And, yes, he says there's some old familiar faces backstage that they cannot speak about on the air. Too hot for television or pay-per-view. Got to reserve it for the hotline. And then we got to the ring for an actual match. We kicked things off with a four-way cruiserweight title match involving Billy Kidman, Juventud Guerrero, three-way match, and Rey Mysterio. Juventud Guerrero was part of the Latino World Order, and against his will, Rey Mysterio was also part of the group. And to show his disdain for this forced joining, he stepped on the shirt as he walked out. And Kidman was only identified by his last name. He was not being referred to as Billy. He was just Kidman.
Okay. I mean, Kidman, I suppose, is, you know, already kind of makes you sound like a kid. But if you, the name Billy, I think, makes you sound even more like a child. Billy Kidman. It sounds like a paperboy.
That's why Gunn has always tried to maintain that youth with Billy. Billy Gunn. Kidman actually came into this match legitimately hurt with a groin injury and a rotator cuff issue. However, had the announcers not brought this up, you would have no clue based on some of the maneuvers of the kid.
And the length and the duration that he wrestled.
Oh, yeah. Oh, rotator cuff, groin. How about you work twice? So Schiavone plugs that tonight would be the most important of Ric Flair's career, which I think is a bit of an overstatement. Kidman and Ray work together at the start on Hoovy. Eventually, they come to blows. Charles Robinson, what hair this man had in 1998.
Great hair.
Like, this was a...
Still has pretty nice hair.
What a look. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Got to see him on NXT recently. I mean, a guy who has aged very gracefully in the past 17 years.
Sure.
Hoovy hit a cross body as Ray then went into a victory roll attempt on Billy Kidman. Kidman then lifted Ray and dropped him on top of Hoovy. Hoovy took a German suplex, landing on his feet right into a Kidman clothesline. Lots of great stuff here. Hoovy hit the springboard Hurricane Rana to Ray off the shoulders of Kidman. And Tanay is bringing up the injuries that Kidman's dealing with. Ray hit a Hurricane Rana off the top rope to Hoovy on the apron to the floor. Only thing I think that you could really complain about was this crowd sitting on their hands as these guys were executing some tremendous stuff. This was the best match on the show. Lots of pinfall attempts and saves. Hoovy and Kidman are on the floor as Ray hit an acai moonsault from the top and then followed with a springboard Hurricane Rana to Hoovy inside of the ring. Hoovy pressed Ray into a Hurricane Rana to Kidman off the top turnbuckle where he was seated. And then Ray and Hoovy are on the floor. Kidman climbs to the top and hits a shooting star press to the floor, nailing the apron upon landing, which did not look pleasant at all. Kidman's success ratio with the shooting star presses, far from flawless during his WCW tenure. And then Eddie Guerrero, who is the leader of the LWO, comes down to the ring. First notable reaction for this whole match. And then Kidman has the cover. Guerrero reverses it in the ring for Hoovy, and then Ray breaks the fall into a cradle by Kidman, who gets the pinfall. 14 minutes and 57 seconds. Before we get to the post-match, I thought this was easily the best match of the show. These three were excellent.
Yeah, I agree. The match was good, but the crowd didn't really get into it until Eddie showed up. And, you know, ultimately, that kind of made the match feel like just a series of really exciting moves, but it felt like the characters and the heat overall probably needed work.
This was a crowd that was very much into stars and not so much flashy moves or anything spectacular, and it was very hard for any of the performers to kind of win over the crowd. It seems like they had their idea of who we were here to see and who were the people that were just filling up time. And even later with some of the stars, it was only the finish that got reactions in some of these matches. It was not a great crowd until the main event.
Well, I don't think you can really criticize a crowd for that, though. A crowd is, by design, should be reacting to stars. You know what I mean? Not every crowd should be an educated crowd that appreciates technical wrestling.
Well, I mean, this wasn't necessarily technical wrestling. I mean, some of the spots, like a shooting star to the floor. I mean, I probably, in 1998, had never seen that before. This is some incredible stuff they were doing.
Yeah.
Afterwards, Eddie just yells in anger. It's the most over-exaggerated yelling. And as he realizes Kidman has won, he cuts a promo on Hoovy and then refers to him and Ray as morons and not being LWO material. And then he makes the challenge to Kidman, calling him not just a cream puff, but a sissy boy. Words that just don't get enough prominence these days when it comes to insults. He says he's probably getting ready to go out on a date and calls Ray and Hoovy embarrassments. And Kidman, if you're in the back and you can hear me, you dweeb,
As he continues to challenge him, Kidman comes out and accepts right on the spot, and Eddie starts backtracking and wants to go change to prepare mentally, but Kidman says, no, we'll do this match right now. And it led to our second Cruiserweight title match of the night involving Kidman and Eddie, and the future Filthy Animals began the match with Guerrero attacking him, and this was a battle way of jeans versus jean shorts, a Shawn Michaels tribute match. Hoovy tried to help Eddie, and Ray would stop him. Eddie then shoved Ray, and then he starts shoving Hoovy as well. And Schiavone asks if Kidman facing three people in one night was a record, which, when the Four Corners match would come its way in WCW, would just be mind-blowing for one Tony Schiavone. Guerrero clips the right knee of Kidman, applies this cloverleaf-style submission, and Kidman then makes the comeback, goes for a sleeper that gets broken. Guerrero then undoes his bootlaces, grabs the boot in the corner, and nails Kidman as the referee is dealing with Ray on the floor. Kidman kicks out of that. Eddie then hits a brainbuster. Kidman stops a frog splash attempt, hits a superplex, and then Guerrero goes back to working the knee. Ray ends up hitting Hoovy with the shoe. Guerrero hits a head scissors off the top rope with one shoe on, and then Guerrero blocks a top rope Hurricane Rana. Kidman comes crashing down, and then Guerrero attempts one. He gets tossed down. Hoovy crotches Kidman on top by accident, and then Guerrero is up. Ray shoves Eddie, and it ends with Kidman hitting the shooting star press. 10 minutes and 48 seconds, and the crowd did pop for the finish as Kidman goes through over 25 minutes of ring time here, retaining his Cruiserweight title, and it felt like a very big push to try and make Kidman and really establish him as the top Cruiserweight here.
Definitely. I mean, you know, it's he very impressive wrestling for nearly 30 minutes, and I think very revealing how much WCW seemed to value the guy by devoting almost the first half hour of their show. I mean, actually,
this
first
was close
hour,
to like 45 to 60, yeah.
All towards Billy Kidman. And, you know, I thought in contrast to the previous match, this match was less about impressive spots, but I thought it was way more interesting because Eddie was just so charismatic in the ring as a heel. And to get to see him out there yelling, frothing at the mouth, Eddie Guerrero. was a lot of fun to watch. In contrast, I mean, I think Kidman, you know, was just far more dry and less experienced, you know, talking. But the guy was still very over. I mean, you know, probably just had the good-looking guy thing going for him, and he's a good wrestler, so was a very effective babyface that way.
And this was just days before Eddie Guerrero would have that horrible car wreck on New Year's Eve, and it would take him out of action for 6 months, and he got thrown from his car and very well could have died. And so this was the last you kind of saw Eddie Guerrero for a number of months, and then would return the following June to WCW. So hope you enjoyed those matches, because then we set into quite the lull of Starrcade. Now remember, this is their big year-end show. This is their WrestleMania. So some of these match selections left you desiring more. We first got a montage of Goldberg and Kevin Nash clips against this very ominous, mysterious instrumental music, as if this was a new, I don't know, Peter Jackson movie coming out. The real Lord of the Ring, Bill Goldberg or Kevin Nash. And then we segued over to Norman Smiley against Prince Iaukea for the granddaddy of them all, yep. Starrcade. This match began as a dragon screw leg whip was hit by Norman Smiley, and Schiavone and Heenan were quick to segue into Ric Flair's hatred of Eric Bischoff, and this match just kind of went on. There was a rolling Kimura at one spot by Smiley, and Schiavone brought up a very controversial angle from a few weeks back where Ric Flair was cutting an impassioned promo in the ring on Nitro and then starts grabbing his chest and had a mild heart attack in the ring. But he is already back after a couple weeks of recovering from his mild heart attack. Smiley does the big wiggle, and this was just as he was starting to go into that character and introducing the big wiggle.
and be more than just a guy on the show, which he largely was throughout 1998. And Tanay is bringing up his background in the UWFI promotion in Japan. Crowd starts to chant boring. They continue on. Smiley hit the big wiggle, and it was the only things the fans were reacting to. At one point, Norman yelled at a fan, "Who's your daddy?" And Heenan surmised that he must be speaking to an orphan in the crowd. Ben Iaukea headbutted him in the groin. Smiley rolls to the floor. Iaukea then fights off a chicken wing attempt. Smiley then applies it, which is called the Norman Conquest, and Iaukea taps out at 11 minutes and 33 seconds, and Tony Schiavone calls this the biggest win of Norman Smiley's WCW career, which may be accurate, but this was a match that was plucked not from a Nitro or Thunder broadcast, but a Saturday night broadcast, and put onto the biggest show of the year and given 11 and a half minutes. And this was the start of some very dull wrestling on this show that the crowd responded in kind with.
Yeah, the match definitely dragged a little too long, and simply because, not because the wrestling was bad, I actually really enjoyed watching Norman Smiley here. His chain wrestling was just a lot of fun to watch, very fluid, very smooth. And the problem is, though, you know, nobody knows these guys, nobody cares about the outcome here. And
these were not over characters.
No. I mean, in fact, I mean, Norman Smiley, I think, a very underrated technical wrestler, but you can do all the great technical wrestling you want. The only reaction the guy got was for dancing. So these fans simply didn't care about the submission stuff. They didn't care about these characters, period.
Scott Hall then came out wearing an outsider's shirt. There was a fan in the crowd holding up this giant WCW credit card as his sign for the night.
Yeah, all planted.
I would imagine so. Though you never know with these WCW folks. Bobby Heenan notes that Hall is a man that has had a lot of problems. Hall puts over DC. He says 1998 wasn't the best year in or out of the ring, and he has no one to blame but himself. He has lost everything he ever cared about, and then talks about his friendship with Kevin Nash, saying he doesn't have to prove anything to anyone except for himself. And he guarantees that 1999 will be his year. I don't know if this goes into our spoiler rules, but it was not his year.
So, yeah, this is pretty much a babyface promo trying to draw sympathy from this audience.
Yes, and Scott Hall was one of many big names at the time on the roster that didn't have a match on this show. And, in fact, the night before on the Saturday night show, they had announced that Hall was going to have a singles match with Bam Bam Bigelow, who was getting a big push coming into WCW, and the match has never happened on this show. I think they came up with a better use of Scott Hall on the show and didn't bother putting him in a singles match, so he just did this interview, which Schiavone called one of his most memorable interviews. Schiavone was very much into the hyperbole of the biggest win of his career, the biggest night of Ric Flair's career, the best, most memorable interview of his career.
Yeah.
Then we cut to a video of Bam Bam Bigelow destroying Scott Hall, who is wearing a Tampa Bay Lightning jersey from the Tampa Nitro a few weeks back, and challenging Nash, being separated by security. And it actually led to a three-way on Nitro between Bill Goldberg, Kevin Nash, and Bam Bam Bigelow, with Scott Hall interfering. And they actually booked Bill Goldberg into a match that did end in a no contest.
Hmm.
I mean, why would you screw around with the streak like that? Just putting a meaningless...
So he's technically 173-0.
Well,
and
his streak was not the most, I won't say protected, but there were some DQs on house shows. They started inflating the number. They really kind of got out of what made it a kind of an organic build. But nonetheless, that streak was incredibly over. Anyway... No Bam Bam Bigelow on this show, realistically. Ernest Miller and Sonny Ono then came out for another great promo, as Miller said he is the greatest athlete and has to whoop somebody. Greatest interview of his career. And then Perry Saturn comes out wearing something that I'm not even going to insult 1998 by stating this was a fashion. This didn't belong in any generation. Do you want to describe what this guy was wearing from the Tupac bandana backwards to
what else was he wearing? Like a leather vest?
It was a It was like a metal-linked vest that you could see his body throughout. And then this red spandex, black boot getup. He looked like a disaster.
Yeah, I wonder how much of this is his own personal influence and how much of it I think he's just doing it for the cameras. But I'd like to think he probably has a full closet of just everything, every type of weird gadget.
Ernest Miller and Perry Saturn was our next classic. Perry Saturn was given 5 seconds to leave as Ernest Miller turned his back to him and counted to five as Perry did the old exaggerated wind-up. And then Miller turned into a punch. Miller teased leaving but then dove in to try and catch Saturn off guard but came up short and got stomped by Perry. Miller then sweeps Saturn, gets the advantage. Saturn went for this double underhook cradle for a two count and was using all of these amateur wrestling-style holds. Tenay then compared Perry Saturn to Mad Dog Vachon. Saturn hit a suplex, a spinning neckbreaker, goes to the top, and then lands on his feet, missing with a double axe handle, and eats a super kick from Miller. And then, as Miller sets up for a kick, he calls in Ono, and the referee is warning him. Hits this running kick, but Perry ducks, and Sonny Ono hits Ernest Miller as Saturn gets out of the way. Miller then kicks Ono and then takes a DVD by Saturn, and Saturn gets the win at 7 minutes and 7 seconds. And Bobby Heenan says, "So much for a man and his cat," as Ernest Miller is upset and leaves on his own, as he was having problems here with Sonny Ono.
I thought, the cat is obviously a very charismatic character, despite even, the lack of experience he had had. But this definitely dragged as well, and again, felt even more like a filler TV match. And in the end, I didn't think there was that much of a point to it.
Okerlund then wishes everyone a happy and prosperous 1999, says, "I know this one is going to thrill them," which could not have been a more inaccurate statement for WCW. Out comes Ric Flair for an interview and says Bischoff still runs WCW and thus the Horsemen have been banned from the building and it isn't going to make any difference on who is here tonight because Bischoff is getting his ass kicked and will beat him piece by piece and wants to break his bones, says Bischoff is going to bleed and he is going to pay the price of wrestling tradition. This was a great promo from Ric Flair.
Yeah, I thought it was an excellent, crazy old man Ric Flair promo here.
The kind of promo that I think only a handful he's been allowed to do since coming back to the WWF in 2001. He's been very limited in being able to go out there. There was the time the Woo was banned. And, in WCW, they just let this guy cut Ric Flair promos.
I don't know if he's this. Part of me wonders if he's capable of cutting a promo like this anymore.
It's been a while since we've heard one. Of this level, at least. Did you happen... I can't remember where it was on the show. Did you happen to see a certain fan in a Wolfpack shirt who would go on to be very noteworthy in pro wrestling, who was in the crowd as a fan?
No. Who?
A young Stacy Keibler was showing, an isolated shot of her holding a sign.
Wow. How old would she have been? I guess she...
Well, she won the Nitro Girl search the following... fall, I guess right. It was. So be within a year she'd be in there, so not terribly young. Okerlund, that ends the interview. And then we had a video on the history of the NWO, Hall and Nash's debut, Bischoff's heel turn, including footage of him firing referee Randy Anderson and then Randy bringing his family and children asking for their dad's job back and Bischoff saying he is still fired. And his catchphrase, "Bite me."
These recaps were a lot of fun to watch in 2015. Just, like a 2-minute compilation of all the highlights from this ridiculous angle. You get to see David and Reed Flair featured in this.
Now, I remembered the Flair heart attack angle. What I did not remember was the setup line by Ric Flair, which triggered said heart attack by yelling at Eric, "You have no heart." And then clutches his chest and goes into the corner. And there were people that legitimately thought this man was having a heart attack on Monday Nitro.
"You have no heart," and then proceeds to get
what are the
heart
odds,
attack?
Way? What are the odds?
What if he said, "You have no brain"?
Oh, Jesus. And then he just, collapses. And then there was a follow-up angle on Thunder, where Rick is not on the show, obviously, from the heart attack. And Eric attacks David Flair, and we also see Reed, a very young Reed Flair, in the ring. And then Eric Bischoff grabbing Beth, his ex-wife, and kissing her on the lips to make this ultra-personal going into Starrcade. This was a pretty big match, given all of the legal issues where Ric Flair was on the sidelines for the majority of 1998, coming back in September, and having legitimate issues with Eric Bischoff, which would culminate in this pretty famous fight that the two had backstage in the WWE in 2003, but working this. And I will say this way, I feel WCW did a better job building up to Ric Flair and Eric Bischoff than the WWF did, which with a much bigger feud, potentially, in Vince McMahon and Bret Hart. Very similar feuds.
Sure.
And I thought that WCW did a better job.
Ric Flair didn't get hit by a car.
That's true. He did have a mild heart attack, which was pretty tacky. Mm-hmm. But Vince and Bret, I don't think it was as handled as well. Mm. Scott Steiner and Buff Bagwell. Their lone contribution to the biggest show of the year featured them walking into Conan's dressing room, calling him a monkey, by the way, and saying black and red is dead to Conan, because this was the splintering of the NWO groups from earlier in the year into the Wolfpack and the NWO Hollywood. And then one of the top five moments of the night, Lex Luger, decked out in FUBU gear for us, by us, and a baseball cap, walks into the dressing room to hold Conan back and calming him down. That was Lex Luger's entire role on tonight's show, the biggest show of the year, so that we could make room for Jerry fucking Flynn.
Mm.
Do you want to hear some of the names, Way, that were collecting paychecks by WCW that were not used on this show? Now, granted, some of these people were hurt, but some of them were not. Chris Kanyon, Kurt Hennig, Roddy Piper, Raven, Dean Malenko, Chris Benoit, Bagwell, Bam Bam Bigelow, both Steiner brothers, Booker T, Lex Luger, Randy Savage, who was hurt, Bret Hart, and Hulk Hogan.
Yeah, that's a lot of money. What was Hogan? I mean, I suppose he would come back tomorrow, but
a week later he would come back. Yes. He was doing. This was when Kevin Nash had been given the book, and Hogan took himself off TV. Did that stupid idea where he was running for president right after Jesse Ventura had become governor of Minnesota. He announced this on the Tonight Show with the idea he had retired, and as a result, missed this pay per view. And I'll say, for a guy that was pretty on the ball when it came to business decisions, like, we've now seen Hulk Hogan's contract publicly of what this guy made. And on a show that did 460,000 buys, Hulk Hogan working this show, do a singles match with Diamond Dallas Page. Mm-hmm. It would have upped the buy rate, I feel, on this. It would have given you legitimately a triple main event. And this guy would have made a ton of money off this Starrcade show, and this show would have benefited from it. And even, I understand the storyline that the Horsemen are banned, but the lack of depth in this undercard by taking out a Benoit, Malenko, I just think this show, it really suffered from both star power and from your workhorses, which weren't on this show.
It really did not feel like a pay-per-view.
All those cruiserweights they had, all the stars from Mexico, that at least if you're going to put these cold matches in it, put it in there with some talent. Instead, we got the tag match of all tag matches involving Jerry Flynn and Fit Finlay, who were fresh off the G1 Tag League tournament from New Japan because of the partnership with WCW, taking on my favorite tag team ever, Brian Adams and Scott Norton, who were accompanied by Vincent.
Why were they your favorite?
Because they weren't. This team, Way, I don't mean to criticize some people, but Brian Adams in 1998, god awful. If you go back to our review of Road Wild 98, his match, I believe it was against Steve McMichael, is one of the worst matches of all time. And this tag match,
at the time, Scott Norton was the IWGP Heavyweight Champion. He was going to be headlining the Tokyo Dome the following week against Keiji Muto.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out alongside Bryan Adams, and Shivani tells us that the main event is now going to be a no-disqualification match. That's the most noteworthy match of, point of this tag match. And then Shivani says that all title matches should be no DQ. So there is a clear-cut winner, and that's what fans want to see. Just throw out the rule book. Tanay notes all of the men's Japanese backgrounds, including Finley and Flynn just finishing the G1 tag tournament. How many times in your notes did you write down Jerry Lynn instead of Flynn here?
None.
Oh, okay. So it wasn't confusing for you. As we got to see Lightning Foot, Jerry Flynn, his mullet. Pretty established mullet by 98 standards, where that look had largely disappeared.
Yeah, I mean, I think all four of these guys rocked pretty awful mullets at some point in their careers.
Except for Vincent.
But everybody's moved on except Jerry Flynn in 1998. Still holding on.
Flynn hit the spinning heel kick to Norton in the corner. At one point, Vincent just stands on the apron and hits Flynn as he runs the ropes right in front of the referee. Like, just blatant. There was zero heat for this match. Shivani advocates for every ruling that gets you disqualified should be eliminated, and then continues on his diatribe. Adams went for a pile driver to Finley, then hit an avalanche in the corner with Norton hitting that, and Tony Schiavone just said, "There is no feeling like being at Starrcade," which is fine to say, but he chose the worst several seconds to say this, because they had this hard camera shot of fans just sitting on their hands looking so bored during this match. And then he goes on to explain in this weird way that some fans sit on the edge of their seats when there's two or three big matches at an event, and people are anticipating those matches to explain why they're so flat during this tag match. Like, even Shivani was explaining to people why no one cares about this. Finley's selling. He finally tags in Flynn. All four in the ring. They kick Vincent off the apron, and then Norton clotheslines Flynn and power bombs him for the win at 8:56. Vincent then goes to raise Norton's arm, and Scott Norton knocks Vincent's arm away. So the B team of the NWO now showing problems to eventually get us to that Scott Norton-Vincent feud that we've been clamoring for since Never.
Do you think Scott Norton could have had a better run in WCW?
I think the guy largely overachieved with the amount of success he had in New Japan. I thought this guy was, I mean, he was not that great. I think he kind of got to the level he was going to be at, personally. Did you?
I don't really have much of an opinion.
I mean, he had a great look that I think very much worked for Japan. And whether it was working in a tag, I mean, the guy was not an outstanding IWGP heavyweight champion. But nonetheless, he had consistent work over there, was very well respected over there, and I think that was the best environment for him. He never really did a whole ton of a lot here in WCW. Eric Bischoff's music plays, but then it just cuts, because first we have to have Gene Okerlund introduce Eric Bischoff, who then comes out. And Eric says hello to Bill, Hillary, and Chelsea. He apologizes to Flair's family. He is sad about Flair's decision to have this match and overcoming the biggest obstacle of having a bad heart. And that is risking his own life, his family's future. And the reason he's doing that is because Ric Flair is broke. He says he never saved a dime after 104 years in the ring, and that the difference between him and Flair is that Flair paid for all his jets and limousines while he expenses his. And then they cut. This was some great transitions by our director. We cut to a sign that read, "Eric is King." Then it cut off to a Canyon equals ratings sign, and then cut to a sign that said, "We miss Hollywood." All heels. All pro heel signs. Great isolated signs to bring attention to. I will say, Eric Bischoff, an outstanding heel, I thought.
Yeah.
Just so smug, and this crowd loved Ric Flair, and they hated Eric Bischoff. And in that regard, this feud completely clicked with this crowd, and they viewed this as one of the big matches they wanted to see.
he seemed very naturally, fitting for the role.
I think he very much played himself, the Eric Bischoff of 1998 that a lot of people, he rubbed people the wrong way. He flat out said he was not a great people person, and I thought he brought that character so well to television. He was just a really, really smug asshole. And he was never, to me, a stark contrast to Vince McMahon. I thought both were really great at this time as the heel authority figures when it was still a fresh role in professional wrestling. We got another video of Nitro, and it was Chris Jericho wearing these hideous-looking tights with cowboy boots, applying a lion tamer to a Conan imposter as Ralphus looked on. Then they cut to his entrance, and Chris Jericho coming out with his WWE entrance music, which they had dubbed over the old Pearl Jam knockoff that he would come out to in WCW. Yeah. I guess not a rights-free theme song for the network to use.
They probably didn't want to risk it. They dubbed over all the knockoffs.
No, and I won't say it, to me, made no difference for Jericho. It made all the difference to me of DDP's entrance, which was just all lost.
With Jericho, it was just a little jarring to hear him come out to his WWE theme.
Yeah, it. But I feel you would have had to have known it, because I don't think if you knew, if you didn't know, I don't think it was. I thought it was a pretty seamless edit.
Very, very seamless. They do a great job. They should have went the extra mile and put in the countdown clock.
No, that would have been tough. Did you see the their screen that they had where the guys would come out and it was just static on the screen, and then they had the fonts of the guy's name on like a torn off piece of paper animation just floating on the screen. Looked horrible. I mean, this is a media company. This is our cutting edge technology. So Chris Jericho comes out. We then cut to more signs, including Washington loves Jericho, and then he cut a promo in the ring. Jericho's wearing the television title, although he had stolen it from Conan, who was the actual champion. He gets on the microphone and wishes everyone a happy Jericho holiday, and doesn't know what Conan's catchphrases mean. And then does his best superstar Billy Graham impression. The women's pet, the men's regret, goes through all the classic lines, and then instructs Conan to pull up his pants before Conan comes out. And I would say this was the peak of Conan being over, in the United States at least. Not so much Mexico, but in the United States in the fall of 98, during the height of the Wolfpack, no one to me benefited more from the Wolfpack group than Conan. Hmm. He was legitimately over at this time in 98.
Mm-hmm.
Came out, I think it was Bobby Heenan who asked where Conan's sword was. I guess a Conan the Barbarian reference.
Oh,
perhaps.
I see.
So anyway, there's a Jericho sucks chant. Conan did his usual opening promo, which really got the crowd into it. This was very much, much like the New Age Outlaws at the time, just someone in the middle of the card who was very much over with the crowd. Schiavone questions if Flair actually did have a heart attack or if Eric Bischoff was lying about the heart attack. The shirt of Conan gets torn off as Jericho is chopping him. Conan gets his boot up at one point, then hits the rolling clothesline and a flapjack. Tanay goes over Jericho's Mexican background as well as working in Japan. Jericho then dives off the turnbuckle, lands on the steps, and then gets set up on the floor. There's a face buster, which gets blocked. Jericho goes for the lion tamer. That's blocked. Conan catapults him into the corner, and this allows the referee to get knocked down. Jericho then gets the belt, hits Conan with it, slaps the referee to get up. Conan kicks out and then comes off the ropes, hits the face buster, and then applies the tequila sunrise to a big reaction for the tap out at 7.5 minutes. And Conan retains the television title.
I thought this was a good match.
This was also when Jericho, his contract would be expiring in a couple of months. They had wanted him to sign an extension. He actually told this story recently on his podcast that they told him, you've got to sign this extension or else you're dropping the title to Conan. And he said, sure, I'll drop the title. And
it's the TV title.
It's the television title. Yeah. What will I do? And so this was the time when he had not signed the extension, and I think they realized this guy probably isn't sticking around, and he wouldn't. And he would work with them until July. The Giant is interviewed by Lee Marshall over at WCW.com, and the Giant gets very mad by one of the questions posed by the late Lee Marshall, and then
points at his forehead and calls everyone computer geeks.
Ouch.
We had some big insults on this show from dweebs, sissy boy.
Cream puffs.
Geeks. Then we had the first of our, I'll say our first of two big matches, because I don't really qualify the giant match as a big one. It was the buffer. We had Eric Bischoff against Ric Flair. And man, was the crowd into this when Ric Flair came out. And Flair just chases after Bischoff around the ring. This was easily the most heat on the show up until this point. Chops, stomps, Flair just beating down Bischoff. At one point, if you caught this, he yells, "This one's for my wife," as he then just clocks Bischoff in the mouth with a punch. Bischoff is grabbing his right knee. Flair goes after the knee. Flair then turns back and takes a head kick from behind by Eric Bischoff, playing the role of Mirko Krokop here. And Flair just slumps down from the head kick. And Schiavone brings up Bischoff's extensive karate background and competing in tournaments all over the country. And somehow this head kick from behind led to Ric Flair being busted open from the forehead.
I didn't catch how that happened.
He kicked him in the side of the head, and this busted Flair open. We had to have blood here.
No, it was a little unnecessary. If anything, it should have been Bischoff that was bleeding.
Yeah, he was taking all the blows from Ric Flair. Flair hit a low blow, and Schiavone is calling for more, and Flair acquiesces and delivers more low blows to Bischoff. He chops the bare chest of Bischoff. Then Flair knocks the referee out and kicks Eric low, giving him the gold dust, golden globe spot, and applies the figure four, but Charles Robinson is out from this. Kurt Hennig then does a run-in and hands Eric Bischoff the brass knucks, and Bischoff leans up, knocks Ric Flair out, and the referee comes to, and Bischoff climbs on top and pins Ric Flair in 7 minutes and 8 seconds. Hennig had been out of action with an injury since September, returning to assist Eric Bischoff. And Bischoff gets the upset win, and this would lead to a rematch the next night with the stakes that if Flair won, he got control of WCW for 90 days, and he would beat Eric Bischoff on the free show, and not the one you bought.
No, great.
So, a trend at this time in both companies, to be honest. But Eric Bischoff wins here. I thought this match was laid out pretty well, and the crowd was into it. Not a classic by any stretch, but I mean, I give them points for the crowd being into it because there wasn't a whole lot they were into on this show.
Yeah, yeah. The crowd, this show was a weird show where it felt like, I mean, certainly the characters were a lot more over in this than the first match, but I mean, I didn't think that this match was that creative, though. You know, I felt like we've seen matches like this with a lot more interesting layouts. This is just kind of Flair beating up Bischoff for a long time, and then Hennig comes in for a run-in, and that's that.
Then they cut to a video for the next match, where the whole video is based around Bret's feud with Diamond Dallas Page, and the Giant is Bret's muscle, and helped Bret essentially steal the U.S. title away from DDP in a match, and the Giant chokeslamming DDP off the stage at Nitro.
So is Bret the champion?
Brett is the U.S. champion, but Brett is not in the match.
But he had to steal the belt? Oh, you mean when
the Giant helped him win the title.
Okay.
So Brett is the champion here. He was dealing with, I think, some kind of knee injury, but was still working. This was also at the time when Wrestling with Shadows had just come out. But again, a big omission, I think, having Brett, who was there in the building, got involved with this, but no match. So we got instead the Giant against Diamond Dallas Page, and as I mentioned, I think DDP's entrance really got butchered here with the editing, where he came out and it felt like just crickets almost, where with the editing. And DDP's entrance was very over at this time with the Nirvana ripoff. The Giant comes out, and the Giant he was pretty much done at this point. He was only going to work another 2 weeks before he would have his last match with WCW and then debut with the WWF in February. So he was just on job duty. The Giant spits at Page, and Page spits back at him to start the match. Schiavone is discussing how Page has come up with an alternative way to execute the Diamond Cutter. He's been coming up with alternate means to hit the Diamond Cutter. Page gets knocked down and sent over the barricade, and ends up hitting the Giant with a perfectly placed trash can that was right there in the front row to be used. Then Page's shoulder is pulled into the post. Giant starts attacking the left knee. Very little heat on this match. Giant does the diamond cutter sign and then goes to this bear hug. Page bites his nose, tries a sunset flip roll up, and gets stopped and dropped into a backbreaker. Page transitions into a DDT that he called the Diamond Dream, and both men are down, which is when Bret Hart shows up with a chair, misses Page with the chair shot, and just cracks the Giant right in the head, and the referee is still out. DDP low blows Bret. Giant then kicks out right away. There's a top rope clothesline by Page. Then he makes the cutter sign, comes off the top, and gets caught by the Giant. Page then low blows the Giant, and as the Giant then tries to hit a choke slam from the top rope, Page turns it to a diamond cutter in midair, hits it, and wins in 12 minutes and 44 seconds, and the fans definitely got into the finish with the diamond cutter being hit. And this would be the Giant's last pay-per-view appearance for WCW, and his last appearance would be January the 11th, losing to Kevin Nash on Nitro.
With the Giant in control for much of the beginning, I thought the match was very slow to start. But it kind of needed to be for the story you're about to tell. I thought DDP had some very good comebacks with some very explosive moves. That diamond cutter at the end looked very good. At the end, though, I can't really say that this put much heat on his actual opponent, which is Bret. I mean, it made Bret look pretty dumb and ineffective. He comes in, hits his own partner with a chair by accident, and then gets low blown by Page. So I thought it made him look like an idiot at a time when I don't even think he should have been playing heel.
No, I think with Bret, I mean, you can look at 1998. A horrible handling of him. I mean, others that have worked with him felt that Bret really mentally wasn't into the WCW run and would have, of course, all the issues in 1999 where, of course, Owen would pass away. He dealt with injuries, and it was just, obviously, Bret's run in WCW, hardly a standout part of his career. Then Michael Buffer is introducing our main event for the evening. And of all the Michael Buffer introductions, nothing topped his introduction for Kevin Nash. This was verbatim how Kevin Nash was introduced. Although he is a native of Detroit, Michigan, his accomplishments and glory from professional wrestling make him a citizen of the world. Kevin Nash. Just the most. I don't care what scripting we complain about on Raw. Nothing to that level. This is how Kevin Nash should have always been introduced.
Citizen of the world,
yeah. Kevin Nash. And then called the best big man in the sport today.
Ugh.
Our booker, Kevin Nash. Goldberg then makes his entrance, starting in the back. Very reminiscent of how the UFC intros are shot. I mean, just with the camera backing up as the guy is walking pretty much all the way out.
Well, I mean, I feel
minus like the autograph in the back for the little kid. I think maybe John Jones could incorporate that.
Aren't these based off of was Goldberg's entrance based off of like boxing entrances?
Yeah, I think a lot of the different the character, the look, and even down to the entrance were very much patterned off of that. But you see, you can definitely look at the boxing entrances, but also, you know, the UFC style that they have, especially for Ronda Rousey's one, where she just does the power walk out there, and you've been there live, and just seeing the camera that's just going backwards, and it's like they're not even on a dolly. It's a guy like walking backwards. It's crazy.
Yeah.
I'm waiting for one where they get stomped over.
Yeah, I'm sure it'll happen someday.
So Goldberg comes out, huge reaction, and as the bell rings, very big buzz. Like, this felt like the main event of the big show, and they had done a very good job building up this match to be something important. I mean, they had put heat on Kevin Nash by winning the Battle Royal at World War III the prior month. Crowd reacts more and more to each guy just making gestures to the crowd that was bigger than anything on the show, with Nash putting up the two sweet sign and then Goldberg getting on the turnbuckle. There was a long headlock by Nash. Goldberg suplexed out of it, Schiavone is comparing this to the Super Bowl. Then they one up that by just saying, oh, the World Series, everything, the NBA championship. No, Goldberg Nash. Nash got on offense, dropped him when he put the big boot up, and then Nash went for some kind of weird transition into an arm bar with his foot on Goldberg's throat.
Yeah, it was like a... I mean, I was actually impressed that it was Kevin Nash.
It's like a neck choke almost that Sakuraba uses today.
I was actually impressed that Kevin Nash was attempting some type of arm bar from like a half guard. I didn't expect to see that.
Yeah, no, I can't even imagine this guy in a gi. Goldberg then decks Nash with his right hand. And I think Nash just legit lost his balance because he fell right down on his ass and was just seated there. And then Goldberg ducked the boot, speared Nash, and then Nash low blows Goldberg. There were a lot of low blows on this show. And then hit him with a side slam. He worked over Goldberg, was attacking his lower back. Goldberg came back with a side kick and a power slam for a two count. And then tried something that I think resembled a spinning heel kick, but I will not confirm that. And then things got weird. When the Disco Inferno showed up, as he was trying to get into the Wolfpack at this time, and he gets onto the apron and gets attacked by Goldberg. Goldberg spears Disco. Then Bam Bam Bigelow runs in and attacks Goldberg. He gets fought off as well. And then in all the chaotic nature of this, these run-ins, the referee is distracted. And Scott Hall, wearing a yellow security shirt, hops onto the apron with an object that appears to have been a taser. And
like a cattle prod.
A cattle prod. Mm-hmm. And tased Goldberg right in the chest behind the referee's back. And as soon as this taser was used, this entire crowd knew what they were about to see.
Mm-hmm.
They realized Goldberg is fucked. And Nash was playing up that he was confused at what happened to Goldberg and power bombs him. Crowd is going nuts. And Kevin Nash pins Bill Goldberg at 11 minutes, 20 seconds, ends the streak. And Nash leaves as the WCW champion. And I will say this. I haven't watched this match in years. But Bill Goldberg, his selling of this ridiculous. It's like, we're going to tase you. Act like you've been electrocuted. Bill Goldberg's selling was great. He was stumbling out of the ring. He was just moving wildly around. He sold... like, this guy was going to explode from this tasing that he had just been subjected to.
Yeah, even during the pinfall, he was, like, struggling really, really well, you know, despite having just been electrocuted. I thought, you know, the match was what you would expect.
I thought the crowd made this.
Sure.
They were hot for everything.
And I think Goldberg, you have to credit a lot for that, too, because, you know, the guy didn't have a million moves, but I thought the few moves that he was known for...
He was the better guy in this match. I don't think there was any question.
I thought that those moves looked very good, probably because some of them actually hurt, but all those moves, the spear, the jackhammer, they were all over. I mean, in contrast, Kevin Nash, I mean, there were times where I felt like I was just watching him... you know, with those knees in the corner, the boot to the chin, like I felt like I was just watching him, this guy stretch for, you know, do yoga during this match.
Doing the picture frame before the elbow in the corner.
Yeah, now that I think about it, I think like, I remember the buzz coming out of this show, you know, back in school, everybody was talking about, oh, did you see, you know, Goldberg lose last night? I wasn't watching wrestling at the time. But I think it was because of this that actually got me to tune into Nitro the next week for the Finger Poke of Doom.
Oh, you just came back right in time.
And that's when I got back into wrestling.
Amazing what pulls you back in.
Oh, yeah.
So this was a pivotal booking decision.
Mm-hmm.
So Kevin Nash wins the title. I mean, at the time, I thought it was really puzzling why you would take the title off Goldberg, who... to be quite honest, when you look back at his merchandise and certain things, he had somewhat cooled, but was still incredibly over. Those Nitro attendances I pointed out, I mean, those tickets went on sale earlier in the year,
And that was all in the wake of Goldberg and that incredible win over Hogan at the Georgia Dome. But since that time, he was not booked as the main event guy for a lot of these shows. It was still Hogan up until Starrcade, where he was put in the main event picture. And I don't know if the idea of beating Goldberg was the worst idea in the world. I will say what they did 8 days later at the Georgia Dome, that was pretty disastrous, because that's when you saw, I mean, they never came close to doing numbers like they did at the Georgia Dome. They cut their gates down, their live attendance, buy rates started plummeting after February. Everything started to drop in 1999. And up until this point, they had been kind of living off the fumes of their past success. And this was certainly a very important match in WCW history. In hindsight, what did you think of the idea of having Bill Goldberg lose at this particular time to this particular person?
Terrible. I mean, I think it would be like if The Undertaker lost to Brock Lesnar, and then Brock Lesnar the next night just basically dropped the title to somebody else without actually wrestling a match or getting anything out of that win. And, you know, that's also assuming that Kevin Nash could wrestle a quarter of the ability of somebody like Brock Lesnar, which he couldn't. So, yeah, not great.
There were a ton of there was a lot going on at this point. In particular, Hogan and Nash, and both guys were heavily angling to be the guy to beat Goldberg. That was part of the discussion of Hogan putting Goldberg over, was the idea he would get the first win over Goldberg. And then with Nash installed as a booker, they were able to, I mean, the guys literally thought that Hogan and Nash were going to kill each other. And then it turned out they worked out something where Nash would beat Goldberg, and then Hogan would get the title the following week, and then they would kind of reboot the NWO that same night with the reformation in Atlanta. And that, to me, it was just a lot of horrible booking that went on at this point. And Bill Goldberg suffered maybe the most out of all of it. I mean, he looked like a fool on that Georgia Dome show, never got back to anywhere near the level of his success that he had in 1998. And you can trace it back to this match, I feel, where kind of that peak point was hit. That was Starrcade 1998. We're going to get to your feedback, but as we mentioned, we do have comments from both Kevin Nash and Bill Goldberg discussing this particular time period in WCW history. First off, we're going to hear from Kevin Nash in 2005, discussing his work as WCW booker in late 98 and into 1999, as well as the finger poke of doom, which he readily admits, that was my idea. So here is Kevin Nash from 10 years ago on The Law.
Going back a few years when you were, you know, the booker in WCW, did that leave you with a bad taste in your mouth, just being the guy in charge?
No, not at all. I mean, that's, you know, I don't have a problem taking heat, you know. I think that you have to be pretty thick-skinned to do that job in any form or capacity. It just, at this point in my life, it's just not something that that I want to spend that much of my time on.
Right. How difficult was it for you at that time, where you were the head booker and you were also one of the top talents? Did you feel it was a bit of a conflict of interest? And I imagine there had to have been heat on by you from some of the guys.
Oh, yeah, there's always going to be. But, you know, at the same time, it's... it is what it is. I mean, you know, the business is full of guys that sit around and complain, and, you know, nobody wants to take, you know, they take backseat drivers. Nobody wants to get up, take the wheel, and, you know, I wasn't afraid to take the wheel. So whether I did a good job or bad job, at least I had the cojones to get on the wheel and do the best I could.
Right. Being the main guy at that time, can you kind of just take us behind the scenes a bit during, specifically around the fall of 98, where we saw the whole deal where Hulk Hogan went on to the Tonight Show and retired, and then we saw him come back, and you guys then did the whole one finger finish. What were some of the reasoning behind that? If you could just tell us a little bit about that.
Well, basically what we were trying to do is just, we knew that Goldberg was going to be the franchise babyface. And we just try to basically build a heel factory for him and just try to recreate the NWO and put Hogan at the pinnacle and have 8 or 9 guys for him to go through to get the Hulk at Starrcade and just try to format storyline a year you know in advance and then just you know with injuries or you know whatever would happen but just kind of you know to put a game plan together instead of book Monday to Monday like they were doing.
Yeah.
So it was, I mean, that was, and then Bill ended up having an injury, but, you know, he tore his hand up in that limo thing, and that got shot, and, you know, so.
Right.
But you know, we had guys that had creative control over their own storyline, so you can't, you know, you write a television show, and you write 11 segments, and two guys come in that have creative control and say, that doesn't work for me, and then you've got, you know, gaps in the show, and there's no continuity in the show. So as far as ever having complete control of, you know, 100% creative control of what was put on the air. I never had that.
Right. What was the whole idea of the one finger finish? Was that a Hogan call? Was that your call?
No, that was actually my call.
Oh yeah. Do you regret that decision at all? Because a lot of people look at that as one reason why, you know, WCW they drew what 40,000 to the Georgia Dome for that show, and to get that finish, a lot of people had problems with that.
Well, but that was never a booked match. Hogan Nash was not the booked match.
Mm-hmm.
The booked match was Hogan Goldberg.
Right.
You know, so, I mean, that was never a booked match. So, I mean, you know, people can point fingers at whatever they want to, you know.
Right. Okay, well, just moving on from there, just wanted to get some of your thoughts, basically on the contract situation. You've been in both worlds, WWE and WCW. You had the guaranteed contracts in WCW as opposed to, you know, the downside deals in WWE. What do you think was the better system run there? Because we always hear about guys who, you know, all push some of the younger guys, but I think a lot of fans have a hard time understanding that these top spots are worth so much money that really giving that spot up is, you know, almost handing away your paycheck. Being in both environments, what kind of system did you think worked best?
The downside situation, you know, the way it is now with New York, I mean, the downside situation is that your contract.
Mm-hmm.
There's very few guys that are making above the downside. So to me, it's just like, you know, they say it's a downside situation. Well, there may be one or two guys that are lucky enough to make above the downside. So I don't really think that the contract situation ever was, you know, that maybe the 18 months that the place was on fire, you know, when WWF was on fire, yeah, then that was guys made above the downside. But ever since then, when the business, you know, once the business went down, it's like anything else. It's, you know, you're basically your downside, you're guaranteed money. There's no difference in the two.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you hear stories of, you know, some house shows, guys are getting $500 for the house show, and it just seems,
right.
It's the guys on the lower end who are really getting the shaft through all this.
Right. I mean, there's guys. I mean, those guys could make that an independent show 50 miles from their house.
Mm-hmm. Right. We talk to, you know, a lot of guys, and whenever the name Kevin Nash comes up, all of them, you know, almost to a man say, you know, he's a smart dude. And, I mean, throughout your career, you've really mastered that, you know, the behind-the-scenes structure that a lot of fans aren't familiar with. Being, you know, it's a political shark tank, and it seems you have always been ahead of the curve. Has it been something that you were just, from the moment you got into WCW, was something you were aware of? And just take us a bit through the thought process, you know, of what this, you know, the backstage politicking that's, you know, evident in every industry, wrestling not excluded.
Right. No, I just think that, I mean, my background's basically a street background. I worked in clubs and bars, and, I mean, just take what you learn on the street and you apply it to anything else. It's just, you know, I mean, I have the advantage of being a very large human being, so, I mean, it's not push me. So I know that, you know, that, you know, if I stand in your personal space and raise my voice an octave, then 9 times out of 10, you know, I usually can get my way.
And conversely, we'll now hear from Bill Goldberg. This was from Fight Network Radio all the way back in 2007 when he was interviewed by Mauro Ranallo. This was just after the two had called the K1 show featuring Brock Lesnar and Minsoo Kim. And we had Goldberg on Fight Network Radio and discussed his time in WCW and in particular his opinions of Hogan, Nash, and Hall. And he got along fine with two of them and detested one of them.
Whose idea was it for the streak and really the whole Goldberg character? Obviously, you had a lot of say in it, but when it began on that fateful night against Hugh Morris in September of 1998 and it went, 173-some fights, I know the highlight of defeating Hulk Hogan in front of a jam-packed Georgia Dome in 1998 for your World Heavyweight Championship, but how did the whole Goldberg character mystique and the push, how did that all, what was the genesis of that?
Well, the Goldberg character came from me. It came from my love of mixed martial arts, and I wanted to combine what I had worked on so many years, which was my defensive line physique and the explosion that I had, and I wanted to couple with the most realistic style out there, which was MMA, and I was a huge fan of it back then, as I am now, no question. And, my first conversation I had with Eric Bischoff, I said, Eric, no offense, but I'm not going to be some $500 a week throw around the ring piece of crap, like these other guys. I want you to understand where I want to go with this. And I think the guy that really made it happen was Hulk Hogan. I mean, the Thursday Thunder, where I was watching the show, and they announced that I was wrestling Hogan in front of, my home crowd in Atlanta the following Monday, that was the first I heard of it. And I think it was just a whim by those guys. And Hogan as a businessman knew what he was doing, and I owe all the credit to him because I think he talked a lot of people into it. Well, but, it turned out to be a great decision of his because, all I needed was the opportunity to and the forum.
What was your relationship then like with the likes of Hulk Hogan and the outside, Kevin Nash, Scott Hall, Eric Bischoff? How would you label your relationship with some of the other bigger names in the bookers in WCW?
Oh, I think it was very good. Hogan is pure business, man. If he sees money, he's going to go after it. Kevin Nash, has always been a good friend of mine. Scott Hall, I'd rather take a dump and look at what's in the toilet than see Scott Hall's face.
And why is that? Why is that, Bill?
Scott Hall is just, he's a cancer, man. He really is.
Wow.
I mean, he was at the time. I don't know if he is anymore, and I hope to God that he's not. I hope that he's cleaned his life up. But, it was just a struggle, man. Maybe he was trying to initiate me or something, but the reality is, man, I didn't need no initiation. I didn't need to pay my dues, man. I've been on the football field working my ass off for God knows how many years, going up against two guys, three guys each play that wanted to rip my head off.
Right.
So, you want to talk about paying dues. I want to see these guys go out and do two-a-days and lose 14 pounds of practice and be able to have the wherewithal to go out and compete for a job. So, I paid my dues, but they were in a different way. So,
obviously,
it's not my fault.
So what about that way?
Wow.
Yeah.
Speechless. I wonder if he feels the same way today.
Yeah. Again, that interview was from 2007. I don't know if his opinions of Scott Hall have changed over the years. But in 2007, not a big fan of the man.
Mm.
So now we go to people that we are always fans of, and that is you, the people, as we go to the message board at lawradio.proboards.com. And, Way, why don't you kick things off?
We go to Mick Whalen, who says, for the biggest show of the year, Starrcade 1998, certainly did not live to the billing. The Cruiserweight opener was very good, as Kidman was fantastic during this time. It was great to see him have two great matches in 1 hour with the Triple Threat and the ensuing match with Eddie. My biggest guilty pleasure in WCW was Norman Smiley. He was so funny with his dances, I pop every time for the move. The rest of the card was terrible, either for mass quality or poor booking, with the exception of the Page and Giant match. The Goldberg-Nash match was a poor way to end the streak, as it killed the mystique of Goldberg as an invincible warrior. I do not think this was the moment where WCW fell off the cliff. That moment would take place on the next week's Nitro.
All right, we go up next to Bruce from Vancouver. As a WCW agnostic, I was cautiously optimistic about this card. Things started off great with an excellent pair of cruiserweight matches, and it was fun enough to stroll down memory lane with Norman Smiley and Perry Saturn. That said, things became turgid.
Mm-hmm.
Vast vocabulary here from Bruce at the midway point, and the fucked finishes served as a convenient metaphor for WCW's contemporaneous problems with diminishing returns. Though I was never a fan, it was sad to see the palpable and unique mystique around Goldberg dissipate in just another carbon copy champ gets screwed out of the title angle by the time the show was over. That said, Flair selling Bischoff's kicks, telling us that a smarmy TV executive actually belonged in the ring with a decorated legend, was maybe the grimmest indicator of just how far this company would end up falling.
Wolf from Mesa, Arizona. Outside interference in the last three matches, when historians detail the list of issues leading to the demise of WCW, the lack of clean finishes in main events often gets overlooked. The bright side is seeing the personalities of Eddie and Jericho being developed in WCW. They were great to watch back then. As for scoring, you have to give this pay-per-view a handicap. No Hogan, no Sting, no Luger, no Savage, no Steiners, no Harlem Heat. I give it 6 Nash quad tears out of 10. By the way, I place the following finger poke of doom as the worst moment in WCW history, ahead of both the Arquette and Russo title wins. Two formidable opponents faking a finish is worse than a celebrity who wins the title on a fluke. Just my opinion. Boom. John and Wea, where do you guys rank those three title wins from worst to third worst?
Involving Arquette, Russo, and then the Goldberg one. I feel by 2000...
Like the finger poke of doom, I think.
Right. Oh, yeah, and the finger poke of doom. Yeah, I go back because in 2000, that title was largely destroyed, even by the time they got it to Arquette. I think it was completely trivialized, and I didn't see things turning around by May of 2000, much less September when Russo won the title. And Hogan beating Nash, I mean, all you have to look at is the attendance they drew for the Georgia Dome, and then they came back in July with a much smaller return business to the Georgia Dome. And that was a big hit that they took with that Georgia Dome show in January. And it's not one thing that caused WCW's business to collapse. It was just a calamity of errors in 1999. John from Indianapolis. What the hell happened here? I'd argue Starrcade 97 was more damaging to WCW than Starrcade 98. Fun fact, the night after Starrcade 97, they had the Sting-Hogan rematch where the booking was very similar, meaning they actually would have had Hogan regain the belt after just one night and negate 18 months of booking just to please the Hulkster. But this event shows you just how incompetent a company can truly be by killing the golden goose just so a few egos can be satiated. Also, the Hogan-Sting match, the Nitro after Starrcade, they also showed that they cared more about winning ratings than making money, because they put Bischoff's presidency on the line against Flair the next night, and Ric Flair triumphed on the free show. Flair had stated that this angle killed off any hope he had for the company because he found Bischoff citing financial problems as the reason for Flair accepting the match in storyline to be unprofessional. The undercard wasn't that impressive, although Kidman got to shine by working almost an hour in two title defenses. Nonetheless, it's events like these that need to be remembered to show how bad booking can harm your company. Sadly, it seems that nobody wants to learn the lessons, as TNA is now a walking corpse, and WWE is trying to reinvigorate terrible ratings with a Roman Reigns authority feud. 2 Disco Inferno run-ins out of 10.
Joe from Portland. I tried to watch Starrcade 98, and it was just so bad after watching AWA Super Clash 85 last week that I could not get into it.
It was hardly the stellar show.
Instead, I went back and watched Starrcade 85 main evented by the Nature Boy Ric Flair versus the American Dream Dusty Rhodes for the NWA World Heavyweight Championship. May I suggest that you and Wei review this show in the future?
Chris in Ottawa. I used to live in D.C., and if I'd known that the fate of the free world was decided there on a daily basis, like Tony Schiavone said in the intro, I would have had trouble sleeping. Between the finishes and the Flair and Goldberg matches, and Jerry Flynn being on the card on WCW's biggest show, Starrcade 98 is one of the shittiest big events in history. And of course, who could forget my favorite version of the Giant, the fat, smoking Giant? But whoever it was at the WWE Network that red flagged Jericho's Even Flow ripoff and DDP's Smells Like Teen Spirit knockoffs ought to be fired. Those were some of the best things WCW gave to the world. And then he points out Eddie versus Kidman being great, the Goldberg and Nash interstitials being hilarious. Schiavone said, take your chair and go to Calgary, you lame brain. That's about all the positives. He gives the show 0 out of 10.
Wow.
Not a fan.
Ryan from Calgary, when this show came out, I was at the height of my wrestling viewing. I was never able to watch the pay-per-views, but I would watch Raw and Nitro religiously and read the reports from the pay-per-views on liveaudiowrestling.com. Watching it again, I can't help but think that it wasn't that either WCW, WWF, or even ECW were putting on amazing shows. It was that the professional wrestling itself was so over with so many people that it felt great. They were selling tickets and sending those people home happy at the end of the night. The audience was growing, and that covered up for a lot of deficiencies. When that is compared to today's product of which I now only watch the pay-per-views on the network, and I never watch the TV. They're putting on excellent matches almost every time out, but they don't have the right combination of writing, performance, and audience to connect with new fans and grow their audience. I was looking forward to the show, but given the amount of Jerry Flynn, I can't give this any more than 5 out of 10. Questions. If you were to give the street gimmick to someone in NXT to come to the main roster, who would it be, and how far would it go?
I think it you need it to be the right kind of guy that you want to get a hot finish off of. And I think a streak, it really helps someone by hiding a lot of other flaws. If a guy can't go long, I mean, they got some mileage out of it with Ryback, which really helped him in 2012. I don't see somebody in NXT that it really does apply to. And I don't think you necessarily have to go the route of some extensive long streak, but getting back on NXT, a lot of the stars, they go over guys every week, and they win, and then it builds up to a special where two guys that have been winning all their matches face off, and you don't know who's going to win. And I think a lot of that can be taken, and it doesn't necessarily mean giving a guy a year-long streak, but rather just instead of booking them 50-50, you pick your 2 to 3 guys that you are going to protect, and they're not going to lose for a long time.
Yeah, I think streaks these days have probably, you know, current wrestling bookers have probably learned from the past, and they've probably seen that, you know, a streak gimmick can only take somebody so long, to the point where I feel like the WWE now de-emphasizes a wrestler that is actually on some type of streak, so that their identity is not solely based on that one streak, so that when it's over, they lose all their momentum.
And the last one is from Sean in Calgary. WCW summed up in one pay-per-view. Great cruiserweight wrestling, mid-carders with great promo skills, not given a sniff of success, Bret Hart underutilized, and overpaid has-beens clogging up the main event picture. Totally random, but Conan was on Jericho's podcast earlier this week, and Jericho made a crack about still not knowing what the hell Conan was talking about. It was classic. And Jericho's... okay. And that's about it. And then he has a side note here asking for a promo that was not part of Starrcade. All right. Well, great. We appreciate the feedback, folks. Now, next week, Way, as we mentioned, you're going to be off in Las Vegas, and you are not going to be joining us, unfortunately. So we will see you in 2 weeks. But next week on Review Away, we are going to be joined by W.H. Park of Japanese Audio Wrestling. He wanted to pop on to review... as we get back to PWG, we're going to go back to this past August Battle of Los Angeles, reviewing Stage 2, which is Night 2, for those of you that may not be aware. So that will be the review for next week.
There have been people that have been waiting to watch the show because they wanted to know when, you know, we were going to review this.
Well, the wait is over.
Yes.
You can go ahead and watch it. It will be next week's review. I don't know if we will get to Stage 3 or not. We did actually buy both the first nights. So once we're done those, I don't know if it'll necessitate going to the third show, but we'll keep it open based on response. Maybe it'll be something in the new year, because kind of the rest of this year, me and Way kind of have ideas of what to review, which in 2 weeks, one of our greatest ideas ever, Way.
Oh, yes.
Yes. So when Way returns, which we'll announce next week what we're going to be reviewing, it'll all make sense. So, Way, have a great time in Las Vegas.
Thank you.
I hope you don't forget about us. We hope you come back safe.
Okay.
And don't get trampled with your camera work.
We'll see.
If anyone decides to do an entrance in front of you.
We'll see what the outcome is of that fight.
Do you have any predictions?
No.
For the main event? Not yet.
Oh, even if I did, who would care?
Are you going to film the Irish contingent that makes their way to Las Vegas? I feel that was your hallmark of 189.
That's right, yeah.
I want more of that.
I want to be prepared this time, maybe.
I think you should go right in the crowd, and maybe you could do like a time lapse. If you could get like a GoPro and some kind of timer and let it just follow the lobby around, that would be cool.
Yeah, I'll play around with
it. I love time lapse videos. Sure. They're very cool. Mm-hmm. Okay, well, taking us out is this, because what better way to end off our review of Starrcade 98 than by this particular clip? So that will end things off for our review of Starrcade 98. Next week, PWG Bola 2015 Stage 2. So try and hunt it down, track it down. And next week, WH Park will join us. All of your shows are up at liveaudiowrestling.com, iTunes, and follow Way at Way0937 on Instagram for all of his outings in Las Vegas next week. He will be, you can live through his Instagram account. Someone that knows how to use Instagram.
All right.
Okay. Goodbye. Way's done.
All right, Tony, Bobby Heenan, Mike Kinane, gentlemen, I thank you. I want to be the first, I guess, probably to wish everybody here at our nation's capital a very happy and prosperous 1999. I know this one is going to thrill them.